Morning, everybody. It's great to see all of you here this morning. We have a good bunch with us. It's been 2 months since I've been able to stand up here and be with you all in this way, and so I appreciate the opportunity. At the beginning of 2024, back in December in 2023, as we're entering the year, I decided that I was going to try to help out as much as possible. And with Justin leaving and everything like that, I'd said, okay, I'm gonna try to preach once a month. It'll help and provide some well-deserved rest for Bill, and it'll give me lots of practice and everything like that. And then I made it to March. Made it 3 months. It was great. And then I hit April, and I had to slink down to Bill's office and say, hey, is it okay if I don't preach this month? And so I appreciate you giving me the opportunity for that, Bill, and how Bill has done this for 38 years or however long, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday, with class included and all the other stuff, is beyond me. But Bill and Kay, we're especially appreciative of your service to our congregation this morning. Whether if you're a part of our congregation, if you're a regular member with us this morning, what you may realize is that on this particular morning, we have a lot of different, what I'll say, life circumstances in this room right now. We're at a season in our life together with a lot of transition. We have a lot of people graduating, a lot of people coming back home, a lot of people going in a bunch of different directions. We have new children being born. We have barns being destroyed and things like that. And there are a lot of people here this morning who are coming from a lot of different places. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to call our attention to a well-known story, to call our attention to a well-known parable of Jesus, and to just spend some time there. Everything that I'm going to say this morning, you've already heard. This is a well-known story, and you've heard every single point that can be dug out of the story. But everything that we're going to talk about this morning is going to be true. It's going to be true. And all of us sitting here this morning remembering that this story is true, true for all of us in our past and in our present and future, I think will be enough to be impactful. So if you would, turn your Bibles over to Luke chapter 15. That's where we'll be today. And he said to them, "There is a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the property that is coming to me.' And the father divided his property between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed his pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now he's found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older brother was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house, and he heard music and dancing, and he called out to one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And the servant said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed a fatted calf for him, because he has received him back safe and sound.' But the older brother was angry and refused to go in. And his father came out and entreated him and pled with him. And the older brother answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I may celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him." And he said to him, "Son, you're always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost, and now he is found." This is the third parable to come in a sort of string of parables that Jesus gives us in Luke chapter 15. And it begins back in verses 1 and 2. When Jesus is sitting around the table with tax collectors and sinners, and the scribes and Pharisees come by, and they're wondering, and they start to grumble to themselves and say, "This man receives sinners to eat with him," and they're wondering why Jesus is spending time with the people that he's spending time with. And Jesus then gives them three parables to help understand the joy that Jesus experiences when he gets to eat with people like this. And finally, we culminate in this greatest sort of parable here, this most elaborate parable. And it begins, "There was a man who had two sons," which means that in God's kingdom, there are essentially two traps for us to fall into. Two ways, generally, to act in relation to the Father and in relation to one another that can cause us to fall away from the kingdom, that can cause us to miss out on a life and eternity spent in the kingdom. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to focus on, we'll kind of look at those two ways. We'll look at the story of the younger brother all the way through, and we'll just kind of touch on some things as we go. And so to begin, we're going to start with the younger brother's decision in verses 12 and 13. Now, it's sort of easy for us to see this at face value, to understand what's going on here. When the son comes to him and he says, "Father, give me my share of the property that's coming to me." And we sort of understand what sort of a slap in the face this is to the father. And if you don't, what I would invite you to do is, at any point in the week, just call your parents up and tell them, "Hey, I want half of your stuff. give me the half of your stuff that's coming to me." It's very presumptuous, and it's a slap in the face to the father. And it's almost laughable. But then when we start to see it in its context, it becomes even worse, because this is happening in a point in time in the Roman Empire where 33% of the population were slaves. Right? We're talking about an incredibly brutal economic environment. There wasn't a lot to go around, and this family happens to be well off enough to have some land and some animals and things like that. And here comes the son, and he says, "I want what's coming to me. I want my portion of the land." And maybe it's land that's been in the family for a long time, but the father agrees to it, and he gives the son the land. And the son immediately sells the property. He sells the family farm, or his portion of it. He gets the cash, and he skips town. And this seems like such an egregious move, right? It seems such a wild move, such an enormous slap in the face, that it's hard to relate with something like this, right? But I think when we look at what's happening here at the heart of this decision, it seems very familiar, which is a bit frightening. Which is essentially that as the son comes to the father, and he's asking for his inheritance early, and when he sells the land and when he moves away, essentially what he's telling his father is two things. First of all, he says to his father, "Our relationship is based around the stuff that you give me. And frankly, I'd rather have the stuff than you." And second, he says, "My life and my future will be better and more prosperous if you're not in it." And so he asks for his property, he sells the property, and he skips town, and he cuts ties completely. And this seems harsh, but he doesn't tell his father this explicitly, but it shows up in his actions. And I think it's sort of the same way with us. It's a reason why we can relate with this story, because we say the same thing through our actions at different points in our life. And I'll give you a couple examples. Example number one, there are times in our life where life isn't going our way, right? where we have God, but we're not getting all of the extra stuff and the stuff that we really care about. In those moments, how often do we cut God out of our life, right? Until the stuff starts coming back, until things start going our way again. Or maybe more common, I think the story speaks to our capacity to pick and choose the things that we allow God to have control over in our lives. Because all of us here in this room, or most of us here in this room, know what God tells us about money, right? And how we should frame money in our mind and the place that we should allow it to have in our lives. But what do we spend most of our time striving after, right, and living for? And most of us, all of us, know what God tells us about gossip, right? But what do we find ourselves most often talking about, right? Other people. And we know what God tells us about telling the truth and about lying, right? And we know what God tells us about anger. But what I would suggest is that most of us here in this room, we like to sort of pick and choose some of those things. But then we read some of these very clear commands from God, and we say, those are out of touch. Right? Those weren't meant for the 21st century, and those weren't meant for me. And God can have control over these portions of my life, but these portions of my life, I'll sort of dictate myself. And I think if I sort of navigate my own path through life, and I take control of my own existence, things will work out better for me. And over time, I think what we find, and you've probably discovered this in your own life, and I know I have, is that when we do this too often, as time goes on, we find ourselves cutting ties with God. We find ourselves taking more and more control over our lives and cutting God out of our lives. And then we find ourselves in a situation that the younger brother finds himself here, working with pigs. Right, yeah. Okay, so we have the decision. This is the decision that the younger brother makes. It's the decision that's at the heart of most of our mistakes in life. And where does it lead? Well, skip down into verse 17 here. Down into verse 13. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in the country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him out to the field to work with pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. It's a pretty dire situation to wind up in. He's hungry, and he's hanging out with pigs all the time, which is making him ritually impure, and he's in a tough spot. And so after we find that we've made these decisions in our lives, what does the younger brother do to return to his father? I think he does two things. First of all, the younger brother reflects on his life, and he realizes that he was built for his father's house, not for his own way of life. A few years ago, it's actually not a book, really, but it's a commencement speech by David Foster Wallace. It's a very famous speech that David Foster Wallace gave, and you probably know it yourselves, but there's a portion of it that I find very very meaningful. I'd like to read it for you here, because I think it describes the situation sort of perfectly, the kind of climax that this younger brother comes to. This is a sort of a secular philosopher, and he's speaking to an audience of college students, and he says, "Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some of the sort of God or spiritual type things, these sort of organized religions to worship, is that pretty much anything else that you decide to worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. You'll never feel that you have enough, and that's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you," which is a pretty brutal way to put it. And on one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified in myths and proverbs and cliches, and they're the skeletons of every great story. The trick is keeping the truth up in front of you, in front of your daily consciousness. Worship power and you'll feel weak and afraid, and you'll need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you'll always end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. The insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious. They're default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And this is where the younger brother finds himself. He's decided to sort of take his life in his own hands, and decision after decision after decision has led him here to the point where life and the things that he has decided to worship has chewed him up and spit him out. And he's here, and he's on the ground. And then it says in verse 17 that he came to himself. He came to his senses. And this is a seemingly small point, but I think this is an important point to make, because I don't think we understand the importance of being able to reflect on our life and being able to just, like, pause, right, and come to our senses. One of my favorite poems, just one of the most annoying things to say, but one of my favorite poems is by John Greenleaf Whittier. I was an English literature major for a year, and it was an enormous waste of time, but I read this poem. It was like the one thing that I'd read, and it's fantastic, and it was written as a sort of anti-slavery poem, and the whole thing is sort of... It's sort of sarcastic. And it begins, "Have you heard of our hunting o'er the mountain and glen? Through the canebrake and forest, the hunting of men. The lords of our land to this hunting have gone, as the fox hunter follows the sound of the horn. Hark the cheer and the hollow, the crack of the whip, and the yell of the hound as he fastens his grip. All the blithe are our hunters, and noble their match. Though hundreds are caught, there are millions to catch. So speed to their hunting o'er mountain and glen, through canebrake and forest, the hunting of men." And he goes through the story, and he's talking about how all of these different people that make up society, right, these priests and these politicians and these, you just name it, they're all joining in this horrendous act, right? And eventually, he talks at the very end of his poem about the person who's a part of all of this going on, and he pauses, and he starts to think about what he's doing. "The politics statesman looks back with a sigh. There's doubt in his heart, there's fear in his eye. Oh, haste, lest that doubting and fear shall prevail, and the head of his steed take the place of the tail. Oh, haste, ere he leave us, for who will ride then for pleasure or gain to the hunting of men?" It's a brutal, brutal poem, but the point is this. When we pause and we reflect on our lives and really think about what we're doing, when we think about where we're at, that gives us the power to stop evil in the world, and not only the evil that we're perpetuating in the world, but the evil that we're falling victim to. And it's what happens here in this story, and it's something that's becoming increasingly difficult to do as we have this thing in our pocket that's just like an unlimited supply of dopamine. But here we have this man who's made his own decisions in life, and he's fallen on his knees, and he's not sure what went wrong. And he has the sense to just like reflect for a few minutes and realize that the place where he came from is better than the place he was now. And if you want to do this just practically, right, just take like 30 minutes, go on a walk and ask yourself, without distractions, ask yourself if you've become the prodigal son. Ask yourself if you're in the state that he is. Are you hungry? Are you starving for meaning and purpose and fulfillment in life that never gets satiated? Have you surrounded yourself with people who never help you, but who constantly just push you down? Do you feel like you're perpetually impure and constantly dirty and defiled, like you can't even think about God, whether or not, let alone approach him? This is the place where the son is, and what he realizes as he's falling down is that the place where he's come from is better than the place where he is right now, that the kingdom that he was made for is better, and that he needs to return to the Father. And when you find yourself here, before you fall into the initial temptation of blaming others for where you've wound up, ask yourself how you've got there, and then do the second thing that the son does here, which is that he realizes and accepts that he doesn't deserve to be in the Father's kingdom. Look down in verse 18. He comes to his senses, he takes a moment to reflect on his life, and he says, I will arise and I'll go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven, and I've sinned before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And this again seems like such a small thing, but I think when we look down at the end of this chapter, what we'll find is this is like the defining characteristic between the two sons. As we get down here in verse 25, we read this very, very chilling story of the older son. Now the older son was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house, and he heard music and dancing. And keep in mind, he's probably believed that his brother is dead. And he called to one of the servants, and he asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he has received him back, safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. And he starts to say all of these terrible things, like, that son of yours, right? And he's very resentful and he's very angry, and it's so chilling. Because one, it's so cold and resentful, but also it's so realistic, right? We can hear it in his voice. And I can hear my voice there. And so how do we keep from being the older brother? How do we keep this from happening? Well, an interesting thing about the story is that initially, the brother is angry, right, when he hears this, which means that this isn't like a thought process. It's an initial knee-jerk reaction. When the father hears that the son has come home, he's overjoyed, right? He's happy. But when the older brother hears that his brother's come home, he's immediately angry. And what does it mean? Well, it means that this wasn't a decision in the moment, but it's a decision that's been happening time and time again over time. It means that it's sort of a state of mind that he's been in. And what's the state of mind? He reveals it in verse 29. When his father comes out to him and he answers, look, these many years I've served you. And the word here is doulos, which is referring to I've served you like a slave, right? And I've never disobeyed your command. And you've never given me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. And essentially what he's saying is this. For as long as I can remember, I've been serving you. But I've been serving you as a slave. Right? And the entire time, as the older brother has been serving the father, what he's been thinking is this is beneath me. Right? I'm his son, right? This work is beneath me. Right? I've been serving you as a slave, right? And the younger brother, when he comes to his senses, that's exactly what he wants to be. That's exactly what he knows he deserves. Right? He deserves to come back as a servant. It's not beneath him. And this one change of mind, right? This one change in the state of his mind allows him to, I mean, it causes him to be resentful here and sort of spiral, and it's frightening. And the thing is, the older brother's kind of right, too, because he has been serving him. And the father doesn't even try to defend the younger brother's actions, right? Whenever the older brother brings up all of these grievances about how he's served him for so many years and everything, and how this person went and disobeyed, how the younger brother went and disobeyed, the father doesn't immediately jump into a defense about, like, well, you know, he's we don't know what he spent his money on, and you know, he's in his 20s, and what are you, he doesn't do any of that. The father knows that the younger brother, he's realistic, and he knows what the younger brother has done, and he's unwilling to reject his son just because of his actions and just because of his mistake. That's the father's version of justice. And what we see here is that when the older brother is unwilling to accept that, he begins cutting himself out of the family, right? He doesn't address his father as father. He talks about his brother as your son, right? And he immediately begins to distance himself from the family because he's unwilling to accept his father's notion of justice. And so this is the decision. This is the situation that the younger brother finds himself in. And this is our story. And this is what it takes to come back to the father. And this is the response that he finds. Down in beginning in verse 20. He arose and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion. And he ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven, and I've sinned before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And before he can launch into this like much longer statement that he had already made a couple verses earlier, the father cuts him off. And he says, quick, bring the best robes and put it on him. And I think what we expect to find here, and I think maybe what the son expects to find, and what we expect to find when we return to our God after days or months or years of being away from Him is a sort of probation, right? A sort of relationship at a distance, but that's not what the Father does. He brings out a robe and puts it on him. He puts a ring on him, right? Probably a signet ring, right? He gives him a checkbook, right? He puts them on his hands. He puts shoes on his feet. And he kills the fatted calf. This is an enormous expense. It sort of fed like 35 to 75 people, which in college minister math, it's like 30 pizzas. This is a big party. And he does it all for the son. He doesn't get forgiveness and relationship at a distance. He gets full restoration to that relationship. And that's a significant thing. All three of these parables, as Jesus has been talking, they've been about celebration. The joy that a shepherd has whenever he finds a lost sheep, the joy that a poor woman has when she finds a lost coin, and finally the joy that the father has when the prodigal son comes home. It's a joy that we all have shared in our past. This is all of our stories. And it's a joy that we get to continue to share in as we go. It's a choice. And what's most interesting about this parable, of course we know, is that it doesn't end, right? It sort of trails off. And you can imagine as the tax collectors and the Pharisees are standing around, and Jesus finishes this parable with this thing that the father says, that it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this is your brother is dead and is alive, and he was lost, but now he's found. You can sense that Jesus ends this story, and what I picture in my mind is that the Pharisees and scribes are silent for a moment. They're waiting for him to finish the story because they're waiting to see what the older brother does. Until they realize that it's their story to complete. As people who have been faithful servants for a long time, it's their invitation to continue in the joy. And if you're here this morning, and you find yourself, and you have found yourself, if you've taken time to reflect and you realize that you are away from God, if you've looked back at the trail of decisions that have led you to where you're at, and you've determined that at some point in your life you've cut out your Creator, and that's led to a string of bad decisions, and you're away from God, and you want to come to Him this morning, I want you to know, and we want you to know, that there's not probation, there's not relationship at a distance, but there's full restoration. Right? There's full relationship with the Father in store for you. And for all of us here this morning who have been faithful servants, who have stuck with it for so long, we have the invitation as well to share in that celebration. And I'll invite us all to do that by coming as we stand and sing.